this episode of GeoTalk, we get an update on geocaching in New South Wales National Parks. We hear about two caches that got swept away in the recent floods across eastern Australia. And we discover Australia's first well-rounded hider. All this and more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 69 of GeoTalk for February 2011. And if it sounds a little bit different in the background, that's because I'm actually sitting outside in the backyard. It is hot today, very, very warm in Sydney. In fact, I just looked at the thermometer and it was reading 35.5 degrees Celsius, which is somewhere in the high 90s. But what's making it worse today is it's damn humid. It's quite humid. And we've had a bit of humid weather here in New South Wales over the last few weeks. A little bit different to some of the storms and cyclones and floods that have been occurring around parts of Australia. It seems to have calmed down for the moment, but certainly there's been a lot of cleanup going on. And you're going to hear about two stories, one from Brisbane and or near Brisbane, and one from southern New South Wales about the effects of the floods on geocaches down there. Anyway, as promised, we've got an update on caching in New South Wales National Parks, and the great news is that after a number of years of to-ing and fro-ing and negotiation, National Parks have overturned their ban on hiding caches in National Parks, and now there are a few restrictions that have been put in place, but it's very similar to the Parks Canada setup, which was introduced a few years ago, and it will just involve hiders having to basically get in touch with the park ranger and getting the okay from them. But that's great news, and you can find out more about that on the Geocaching New South Wales website. I'll give you a link to that in the show notes. Now, if you've been following the forums here in Australia, you would have noticed that there's a new magazine coming out that is called Geocaching in Australia. It's being put out by James, who runs the Australian Geocaching Essentials store. You can find out more information by going to his website at australiangeocachingessentials.com.au, and you can find out more about that magazine, which should be coming out in the next few weeks, and that'll be all about caching down here in Australia and New Zealand. And while I'm on the subject of geocaching stores, first of all, we have to say thanks to Ian for his support through geostuff.com.au. But there are a number of other stores that are around, and a little bit of a shout out to Chris, who looks after Jockaroo. That's another geocaching store here in Australia. You can find them at www.jockaroo.com.au. Well, we've got a few things to get through in this podcast, so that's all we've got news-wise for this episode. It's time now to head over to New Zealand with Alan, Radio Nut 50, and to get a bit of an update on what's happening over there.
Yeah, hi, Darren from Alan, Radio Nut 50 here in Hamilton, New Zealand. Now, we all know that the best geocaches are in ammo cans, although many new caches may not have actually seen one of these things. The Army's used this steel box for housing ammunition for many, many years. And these are robust, waterproof, and big enough to hold a good stash of swaps and TBs, so they're very useful geocaching containers. Well, on our travels last Christmas, we passed through Bulls. It's a small town north of Palmerston North, and there's a small Army surplus shop there that I've purchased some ammo cans from before. On a previous trip, I got a lengthy story from the proprietor, though, that the New Zealand Army would not sell him any ammo cans anymore. The ones he has came from Germany, he told me. However, the pricing seemed pretty reasonable to me. On that trip, at the end of the transaction, I was told that drug users buy these things to hide their stash. Then he looked at me in the eye and said, "What are you going to do with these?" Well, I tried to explain my strange hobby of hiding things out in the bush and letting others find them with a GPS, but I'm pretty sure he saw this just as a weak or maybe simply a way of explaining my drug hiding. Well, on this trip, I stopped outside the same shop and wondered what my reception would be. Again, I got the explanation he couldn't get ammo cans anymore, so I selected some better examples from his possibly dwindling stocks. Then, sure enough, while handling my purchase, I got from him, "Some people use these things for hiding their drugs. What are you doing with yours?" Well, this time, I just muttered something about keeping things dry outdoors and I scarpered. So I guess I simply confirmed his suspicions again. All this, of course, happened in a small shop, jam-packed to the eyeballs, with army uniforms, guns, shell cases, grenades, knives, everything the average anarchist or maybe a drug dealer would like. So I would have thought having metal boxes would not be a high priority. One thought I did come away with from this, though, was maybe some of the boxes we come across out there might not be a geocache. Maybe it'd be something much more serious. I wonder if anyone else has had any experience in that. We enjoyed an experience a week or two back with one of our more tricky caches. We'd noted a couple of did not find logs, so thought it was time for a cache check. Now this one's hidden in a special container in a central city rose garden. Well, we were disappointed when we got there to see a number of people and some children wandering round close to where it was hidden. So we thought with this muggle count, we're going to have to give up on the cache check. But then after a wee wait, we realised one person in the group seemed to be tracking around the lawn with something in their hand. So we took the plunge and asked if they were caching. Well, it was neat to meet two separate caching groups that already met together and joined forces, Post-Mix 45 and Scott and Penelope. Both of these were, at the time, very new caches. One, it was their first day, and it was fun to have a chat with them. It's interesting that we'd been caching for around about a year before we met another cacher at a cache. And then we did it a month later. But what made it even more interesting is that the first cache was in Auckland, the second was in Dunedin, but the cacher we met was the same person. It was none other than cacher extraordinaire Wayne the Money Dork, who certainly gets around the country a lot, of course. It used to be that you could recognise a cacher reasonably well, because they were the people pretending to talk like a cell phone on actually on a GPS, or take photos from below a statue with a GPS. I've certainly done a bit of that in my time. But nowadays, of course, it's not that easy to tell, as GPSs do have cameras in them, and many caches use their modern telephone as a GPS, so when they're searching, they look just like 100 others who are texting, wandering around the gardens. This does bring me, though, to one of the inevitable subjects, that although many swear by the accuracy of their iPhones or other smart PDA-type phones, they really don't cut the mustard for accurate position reporting. We've met a few new caches recently who have only ever used an iPhone or something similar, and while this is obviously an easy way to start into our fascinating hobby, it can lead to some seriously frustrated new caches with a pretty low success rate, as their device is not able to get them very well to the right spot. So if you're new to caching and are using a cell phone as a GPS, but may be considering giving it away because you've had too many failures, do join in at a caching event soon and have a play with some other people's GPS devices. You may find the hobby will take on a new meaning with one of these. While reading a variety of logs that we get for our cache hides, I had a bit of an epiphany last week. There are many ways to enjoy a hobby, or is it a sport? For some, it's simply a game of hide-and-seek. Caches can be anywhere, but they should be very, very hard to find. Others use it as a travel guide or a history lesson. Caches should be hidden in an interesting place, a spot that finders will enjoy travelling to and maybe learn something from. For many of us, the hobby is a mix of both of these. We enjoy a challenging cache, and we enjoy being taken somewhere. Back to my thought on the logs. I've noted recently that many new caches always say something very brief like easy find as their entire log. These indicate that they've only been introduced to the hide and seek aspect of our hobby. They're disappointed when they come across a cache that's not very, very hard to find. Unfortunately, they then overlook the fun of the location that many caches are placed at. They, of course, go on to emulate their understanding of the hobby by throwing a film canister into a bush or a nano in the crack of a street frontage on a fence. So my challenge to experienced caches is to chat with newbies every chance you get, especially at events, and talk over the concept of hiding caches in interesting places. To think over what is the reason for putting a cache here every time they plan a hide. I'm sure we'll get some more interesting range of caches this way. So to the events coming up here in New Zealand, in the North Island, there's the Tauranga Caching Capers in Tauranga by Rick and Mortis and Lionfish on the 26th of February, and in the South Island, Ye Trees, Box Hill and Gone Fishing have listed an event called Meet the Three Stooges in Nelson on the 4th of March. That's all the events listed over this side of the Tasman at the moment, Darren, so back to you.
Well, thanks for that update, Alan. I have to meet this guy that you're getting your ammo cans from. He certainly sounds like a bit of a character. And also that's some great words of advice to all the older players, the more experienced players who might be complaining about the hides from some of the new players. It's good advice for them to get together and chat and discuss their experiences, and hopefully they'll learn from them. Well, it's time now for the GeoTalk trivia question for this episode, and this one relates to the GeoGnome game that was, or the project that was occurring across Australia in December and January, and it's a multi-part question. First part of it is, how many gnomes were in the game, and which gnome travelled the furthest, and which gnome had the most number of stops? The answer to that at the end of the podcast. Most listeners to the GeoTalk podcast would have realised over the past few weeks that the state of Queensland, up in the north of Australia, has been hit by a number of natural disasters, and one of them was the huge floods which devastated parts of Toowoomba along with Ipswich and Brisbane and just about everywhere in between. And I'm chatting to someone who is from the Ipswich area, Jason by the name of Penguiny. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Aaron.
Now, before we get into the story, the reason why I wanted to chat to you on this episode, tell us a little bit about briefly about the floods and what sort of effect it had on both you personally and on the area where you live in Ipswich.
We were very lucky where we were. I mean, we still probably had quite about 10 metres or so before the water would have actually got to our house, but down the road, people at the other end of our suburb just weren't as lucky, and we had townhouses go under. Like, we're talking about the water coming up over the second story of some buildings, and people's houses and all of their possessions just completely washed away, houses destroyed. We've got parks down the road that have been completely devastated by the floods, trees ripped out, I mean, it's hard to describe it because it's just unbelievable, some of the areas.
Now, a similar flood happened in 1974, that right?
Yeah, pretty much. There are some areas where the water was actually higher than in 1974. Like, for your listeners that wouldn't be aware, I mean, in our part of southeast Queensland, the 1974 floods are pretty much the standard that's set for what a bad flood is. But from now on, I think 2011 is going to be the new standard. But like, we had areas where the water was actually higher than 74. But luckily for us, and luckily for a lot of people around southeast Queensland, a lot of the areas were just below 74. But it was bad. It was bad.
Now, as far as you're aware, were there any geocaches, actual players that were affected by the floods?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I had a look on the GCA forums, and I can't recall seeing any caches that were affected. But I mean, the thing is, I think at times like these, I think the last thing on a lot of people's minds would be getting on and looking at doing their hobbies, the things they like doing, and getting on the forums to say, hey, my house has been flooded away. Because, I mean, in a lot of cases, I mean, if people have been affected, I mean, their computers, everything would have been gone. So, I mean, there could be people that are affected, but, I mean, I'm not aware of any myself, though.
And I suppose the same for, you know, when people are wondering how many geocaches themselves, the actual containers, have been affected in Brisbane. I suppose that while you guys are still in the middle of cleaning up several weeks after the disaster, it's a little bit hard to work out what's there and what's not, isn't it?
Yeah. It's with the amount, if you think about Brisbane and The areas that have been affected, I mean, I can imagine there'd be a lot of caches that could have been washed away. But, I mean, as you said, I mean, it'd be pretty much the last thing on a lot of people's minds, especially if their houses have been affected, if they've had friends or loved ones that have had their houses washed away. I think it's probably the last thing on a lot of people's mind at the moment. Yeah. But I would imagine the Oxley Creek series is probably not there anymore, but yeah, there'd be quite a few, I think, that would have been washed away.
Now, the main reason why we got you on this podcast is I noticed in the forums that you actually got a surprise email in the middle of the cleanup about a cache of yours that had somehow appeared where it wasn't placed.
Yeah, I did, which was absolutely incredible. I had a cache called Colo Gardens, which was located down at the back of the Botanical Gardens out at the back of Ipswich here at Colo on the Brisbane River. And I got an email from a gentleman that works down at Pinkenbar, which is near the mouth of the Brisbane River. Lovely bloke by the name of Alan. And he emailed me to tell me that he found my geo box, as he describes it. And so I contacted him to organise to pick it up. And the incredible thing was, apart from the fact that it got washed away and got found, it was the fact that it got found when I had a look on Google Maps, and traced the distance all the way along there. He actually found it 90 kilometres from where it went missing. And the weird thing was, it actually went missing we had flooding last October as well, and that's when I first noticed it wasn't there, and I thought it may have actually just been buried under a lot of silt that had been washed up over it. But wherever it went, whether it was washed away then or washed away in the second lot of floods and the big floods we've just had, yeah, it actually managed to turn up. And it actually turned up while he was on the news trying to get the message out about a family's photo album that he'd found floating down the river. And while the reporter was doing the interview with him, they saw the box floating down the river and picked it up and went, oh, what's this?
That's just amazing. 90 kilometres. And so potentially, it may have left in October, but obviously the floods in January, you know, flushed it all the way down to the mouth.
Yeah. Absolutely astounding. So, yeah.
And have you picked it up yet?
Yeah, went around. I had to drive fairway to work the fairway from Pinkenbar, so drove out to pick it up from him. Took some beer for him as well, which I thought was the least I could do. And the other weird thing about it was he had no idea what it was, and he opened up and he was reading through all of the logs that people had left in there, and he was like, oh, this looks really interesting. And he's going, well, I'm not sure whether I should just ride in it and say I found it and throw it back in the river and let it go on its way for the next person to find. So I'm glad he didn't think it was some kind of travel bug, but it was great. So he was a really nice bloke, and he was kind enough to let me know about it. So the plan is, I've contacted the UMP to try and get us relisted, because I'd archived it. So as soon as I'm able to actually get out there, because the area where it was hidden is locked off at the moment. But as soon as I can get out there, my plan is to put it back in its spot and hopefully try and rig some way for it to be a little bit more floodproof. But the amazing thing was, it was in an ammo box and the contents were completely bone dry, despite a 90-kilometre trip down the river.
I'm glad to hear. And another vote for the ammo box, as compared to the Eclipse tin, which I hear is quite ubiquitous up there. Hey, listen, Jason, thanks very much for that that really interesting story, and also giving us a little bit of info about what's happening in the floods. We'll provide a link on the website to the Premier's flood appeal, along with a couple of other appeals that are occurring around the country. I mean, if you haven't heard, Queensland obviously got hit by a cyclone a few weeks later, and of course now we have bushfires in Western Australia and floods in Victoria. So to everyone who's been affected, our wishes, our thoughts go out to you, and check out the links on the website. Once again, Jason Penguiny, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
My pleasure, Darren. Thank you.
Now, thanks to Penguiny for that interview about that amazing adventure of a geocache travelling 90 kilometres down the Brisbane River and then happened to be found. And it makes you think or wonder how many others have sort of suffered a similar fate throughout Queensland and parts of Victoria and New South Wales. And in fact, there has been another one that has recently been found. And Rooster Man Greg down in Wagga Wagga pointed me to an interview. And you can find that on the ABC Riverina website. And I'll give you a link to that in the show notes. But here's a little clip from that interview about a farmer who found a geocache wash up on his property.
Let's have it. Get the lid off. Oh, there we go.
There we go. So the notebook was just completely stuck together, and it was sort of as though everything was with a glue. We didn't think we'd ever be able to even read it, but we're able to. And then there's a pencil, a screwdriver, badge of some sort. Even the Sturt Mall got a mention, the veterinary surgeon. So, you know, you can trace it out by those things, surely. And then those wheels and a little toy head of a baby's doll or a fairy or some item like that. So why would you have such a mixture?
What about the notes? Could you read any of the notes?
You could not really read them, but you could see that they would be able to be read when they were dried properly. You could and hope the ink didn't run too much, which it did on a few, but some are quite clear and easy to read, you know. But they don't make much sense to me. I mean, what's TFTC, for instance? Great spot, TFTC.
What do you think? It's a bit of a modern message in a bottle.
I'd say definitely a message in a bottle. First thing Anna and I said, oh, gee, a message come down in the flood. And, you know, you often read books about the message in the sea. Well, the Murrumbidgee River's sent a message down to us. It was all mystery to read the little notes. I mean, one just says TNLN, thanks, EUCO. So, you know, you've got to... it might be some secret society.
We'll have to find out what we can. Thanks, Keith.
Yeah. Thank you.
Now it's time to have a look at some of the events that are occurring around Australia. And on the 26th of February, there are two events over in the Bendigo region. There's the Meeting at the Mall Flash Mob event number 2, and that's quickly followed by the Morong Family Hotel event for tea. And they're occurring, as I said, in Bendigo and central Victoria. On the 27th of February is the third annual Hills geocaching event over in Sydney. On the 5th of March is GeoGain 2011. That'll be in the Adelaide suburbs. And on the 6th of March, there's the WA Caching 10th Birthday Bash that's being held down in Albany, down there just south of Perth. And also on the 6th of March is the Clean Up Australia Day 2011 event being held down in the Illawarra. And finally, on the 16th of March is Before the Clipsall Pub Lunch over in Adelaide. And we've got one more event we want to highlight that's occurring in April. It's time to go over to Tiger's Den.
We're holding an event in a place called Lanakuri, which is southwest of Bendigo. It's about 35 km. It'll be based around the caravan park, which is on the river that's down there. It's a 2-day event, starting pretty much 9 o'clock on the Saturday morning. It'll go for the whole weekend, ending at about 4 p.m., 5 p.m. on the Sunday evening. We will have an egg hunt for the children on the Sunday morning. We have over 50 caches hidden so far just for the event, which will continue to operate after the event. We have lots of socialising games if you don't want to go out there and crunch the numbers. So there's half a dozen caching games and socialising games. There'll be games for the kids as well. Oh, and there will be a dinner on the Saturday night, a big spit roast that we're putting together, which is $15 a head for adults, $10 for children. Just bring your own drinks and sweets.
And you've got quite a list of sponsors involved in the event. Take us through some of those.
All right. Our major sponsor is Next Destination. They have donated a Magellan GPS for us for the major raffle, which is going to be excellent. We also have Pertec Bendigo. They've donated a few items. Toy World Echuca. Coliban Water in Bendigo have donated the Enviro bags for the registration kits. The Denali Bakery is putting together some vouchers. Oak Coins have sent us a good little package for the raffles and prizes. PathTags.com have given us their vouchers. Office Choice Bendigo have supplied a lot of the administration gear to pull off the event. And we've also donated a few coins and tags. We've also got a site called Tiger's Den Designs because we designed geo coins and path tags, all that sort of stuff. So we're donating a whole heap of stuff for that as well.
And if people want to find out more about it, how can they get in touch with you and what's the GC code?
Okay, the GC code is GC2JYQN. It's called the Pre-Easter with the Central Victorian Geocaches. You can contact me by email at with tigersden@live.com.au.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast and good luck with the event. And hopefully we'll hear back from some of the people that attended.
No worries.
Well, we got a few emails in the Geo Talk mailbag for this episode. The first one actually comes from the US, and hi to all the US listeners. It's amazing for a podcast that's about geocaching in Australia and New Zealand. Probably about half of the listeners are actually from the US, even a few from China, which is quite surprising. So hello to China as well. But we've got an email here from Zemi, who lives in Wisconsin in the US, and he wanted to give a bit of a shout out and also mention his caching achievement of 2011, which was to complete his well-rounded cacher grid. Now, he said he had two to find recently, and they were fairly close to each other, only 5 kilometres apart. And the only thing was they were actually both 90 kilometres away from home. So a little bit of a drive to get there. So he told the missus to pack the kid in the car, and they went off on a caching road trip. Now, the first one he had to find was a 5-1 cache, part of a 13 cache series that based on their favourite snack foods called Twinkies. And it only took a few minutes to make the find, so that was fairly easy. But the next one was a 4-4.5, and that was part of a 39 cache series based on Harry Potter books. And this one was called Crab and Goyle version 2. And it was by the same hider, and he says that, yes, this hider likes to place themed caches. And this one was a doozy. It was hidden in the breakwater on Lake Michigan, and it was an ammo can. He said I had to crawl around for a while and then realised that I would have to shimmy down between the rocks. I slid down and caught a glimpse of a set of sticks lined up just too perfectly. Problem, I had to climb through a somewhat tight fit while making a turn. I squeezed through and retrieved the can. I backed out and got back to the path. So after 4.5 years of caching, he's finally found all 81 difficulty and terrain combinations. Now to finish off that caching calendar. Well done, Zemi. I think it's something that not many of us, have, particularly in Australia, have completed. So well done on doing that. I got a question now from Groovy Doo, who says, I've downloaded all the podcasts and listened to them while I'm out walking the dog. Thinks they're great and keep them coming. Well, thanks very much for that, Groovy Doo. But he has a question here. He says, while he was surfing on the web, he came across a review for a case for the iPhone. Now, it's made by Magellan. It's called the Magellan Tough Case iPhone. And you can find that at geek.com. I'll give you a link in the show notes to it. He says that he'd like an unbiased review because he found the cost is somewhere in the order of $270 to $330. And he seems that the iPhone doesn't cope well in the water or with perspiration, so it'd be great to find out what this is like. Now, I spoke to Daryl W4, who's the host of Cacher Maniacs and Geocaching Podcast, because he's a bit of a gadget review guy, and I knew that he had actually got his hands on one. And he said to me, I haven't got the review done yet since I haven't had the issue addressed with the GPS failing to update. He says he needs to update the touch and give it a try again, but generally people that he's spoken to are very upset about the GPSR that's attached to it. So in the meantime, he's waiting for this issue to be resolved before he can give it a really good review. He did say, though, that he got a response back from Magellan, the manufacturer of the unit, to say that they had determined that there was an issue with the GPS firmware and that it affects the GPS updates when moving at slow speeds. They said they've corrected the issue and they should have new tough cases built in the next few weeks. So hopefully we'll hear more about that when those new units are out. And we've got an email from Webwitch, also known as Robin, and I think Robin is from Sydney, if I'm correct. She says she's a geocacher come lately, having only become assessed by the activity in December of last year while out on holiday in Florence. And she heard it through a friend on Facebook. She says, of course, as well as playing as often as possible, I've been trying to read up and listen to everything I can possibly can about geocaching, including back episodes of GeoTalk. Well, thanks very much for listening, Robin. She says, though, it makes her sad when she hears about people complaining about caches of size they don't like or in places that are not of their taste. Like caches, geocaches come in all shapes and sizes. And she says that she's a woman in her late 50s and somewhat unfit. And because her husband has Parkinson's and lives in a nursing home and her children have families of their own, caching is a diversion that she usually does on her own between working and visiting her husband. She says urban drive-by caches suit her lifestyle well, and while she would love to be able to trek into the bush to see mountaintops or bush clearings, it's beyond her capabilities. She says she likes micros and enjoys the effort that it takes to find them or to solve the puzzles that go into the to get you to GZ. Without young children, she doesn't care too much for the trinkets in a regular cache, although she does enjoy finding trackables and helping them to move on. She prefers a cache that teaches her something about a new place, something that she wouldn't normally go to see. She says she accepts that there are young, fit teams out there that trek through the bush to find ammo cans filled with interesting bits and bobs to explore and exchange, but she can't understand why people complain about cache placements and high types that aren't to their taste. Thank you for the work that goes into the podcast. The programs are informative and interesting, although whenever I talk about death adders in Sydney, that seems to send her back to the urban micros of La Bella Citta. Well, look, thanks very much for that email, Robin, and you do raise a good point. And I think, you know, occasionally I've probably been guilty of complaining about certain cache types, in particular micros. I think, as you point out, we're each to our own, and maybe, you know, we just need to remind ourselves that some people do enjoy some of the caches that we may not, and whether it's for numbers or whether it's just because they are rather explore urban areas, then we should accept that that's the case. So thanks very much for that email. And our final email comes from Nigel over in Adelaide, also known as Zitherin, who's very famous for his puzzle caches over there. He said, Darren, just wanted to drop you a late note for a New Year's resolution that has just been completed. He says, after hearing a few records for 4-4 and 5-5 all-round finders, I thought I'd drop you a line to say that Australia now has its first all-round hider. He says his last cache, which has gone out, GeoGain 2011, fills in the last of the caches hidden by difficulty and type on the chart. So congratulations to that, Zitherin. I'm sure that anyone who's found all of your caches now will find that they're a well-rounded finder as well. Now, don't forget, everyone who's sent in an email to us or sent in any audio, they get a free path tag, a GeoTalk path tag. So don't forget to drop us your postal address in the mail. And if you want to get a path tag or you just want to just be part of the show, drop us an email, geotalkpodcast@gmail.com, or call it in, which is probably just as easy, on 02 800 5436. That's 02 800 5436. Well, that's about all for this edition of GeoTalk. Sitting outside in my backyard trying to get a bit of breeze on this hot day. And apologies for those planes that flew over earlier. Before we go, the answer to the trivia question, and that was how many gnomes were in the GeoGnome project that was held during December and January, and which one travelled the furthest and which one made the most number of stops? Well, the answer, and this is just amazing, there were 236 gnomes in the GeoGnome game. That'll explain why I keep seeing them pop up at local events recently. The one that travelled the most was Firesafe Ho by Firesafe from South Australia, which managed to travel 37,783.85 kilometres. not bad for a travel boat or a moving cache in 2 months. And the one that made the most number of stops was the Grey Old Genome by Mr. Roo from ACT. It travelled 2,136 kilometres, but in that time made 42 stops. Well, that's all for this episode of GeoTalk. Until next time, safe geocaching.